long, their clothes tattered, their faces yellow with dust.
"Poor women," Rachel said with a sigh. "Hélène Ruel told me this morning that at least a dozen refugees came to town late last night. The stories they bring are not good, but no one embellishes a story like Hélène."
Ordinarily, Vianne would make a comment about what a gossip Hélène was, but she couldn't be glib. According to Papa, Isabel had left Paris days ago. She still hadn't arrived at Le Jardin.
"I'm worried about Isabel," she said.
Rachel linked her arm through Vianne's.
"Do you remember the first time your sister ran away from that boarding school in Lyon? She was 7 years old. She made it all the way to Amboise, alone, with no money. She spent 2 nights in the woods and talked her way onto the train."
Vianne barely remembered anything of that time except for her own grief. When she'd lost the first baby, she'd fallen into despair. The lost year, Antoine called it. That was how she thought of it, too. When Antoine told her he was taking Isabel to Paris and to Papa, Vianne had been, God help her, relieved. Was it any surprise that Isabel had run away from the boarding school to which she'd been sent? To this day, Vianne felt an abiding shame at how she'd treated her baby sister.
"She was 9 the first time she made it to Paris," Vianne said, trying to find comfort in the familiar story.
Isabel was tough and driven and determined. She always had been.
"If I'm not mistaken, she was expelled 2 years later for running away from school to see a traveling circus. Or was that when she climbed out of the second-floor dormitory window using a bedsheet?" Rachel smiled. "The point is, Isabel will make it here if that's what she wants.
God help anyone who tries to stop her.
She will arrive any day, I promise, unless she has met an exiled prince and fallen desperately in love. That is the kind of thing that could happen to her."
"You see," Rachel teased, "you feel better already. Now come to my house for lemonade. It's just the thing on a day this hot."
After supper, Vianne got Sophie settled into bed and went downstairs. She was too worried to relax. The silence in her house kept reminding her that no one had come to her door. She could not remain still. Regardless of her conversation with Rachel, she couldn't dispel her worry and a terrible sense of foreboding about Isabel. Vianne stood up, sat down, then stood up again and walked to the front door, opening it. Outside, the fields lay beneath a purple and pink evening sky. Her yard was a series of familiar shapes. Well-tended apple trees stood protectively between the front door and the rose and vine-covered stone wall, beyond which lay the road to town and acres of fields, studded here and there with thickets of narrow-trunked trees. Off to the right was the deeper woods, where she and Antoine had often sneaked off to be alone when they were younger.
Antoine.
Isabel. Where were they? Was he at the front? Was she walking from Paris?
Don't think about it.
She needed to do something. Gardening. Keep her mind on something else. Retrieving her worn gardening gloves and stepping into the boots by the door, she made her way to the garden, positioned on a flat patch of land between the shed and the barn. Potatoes, onions, carrots, broccoli, peas, beans, cucumbers, tomatoes, and radishes grew in its carefully tended beds. On the hillside, between the garden and the barn, were the berries, raspberries and blackberries in carefully contained rows. She knelt down in the rich, black dirt and began pulling weeds. Early summer was usually a time of promise. Certainly things could go wrong in this most ardent season. But if one remained steady and calm and didn't shirk the all-important duties of weeding and thinning, the plants could be guided and tamed. Vianne always made sure that the beds were precisely organized and tended with a firm yet gentle hand. Even more important than what she gave her garden was what it gave her. In it, she found a sense of calm. She became aware of something wrong slowly, in pieces. First, there was a sound that didn't belong, a vibration, a thudding, and then a murmur. The odors came next. Something wholly at odds with her sweet garden smell, something acrid and sharp that made her think of decay. Vian wiped her forehead, aware that she was smearing black dirt across her skin, and stood up. Tucking her dirty gloves in the gaping hip pockets of her pants, she rose to her feet and moved toward her gate. Before she reached it, a trio of women appeared, as if sculpted out of the shadows. They stood clumped together in the road just behind her gate. An old woman, dressed in rags, held the others close to her, a young woman with a babe in arms, and a teenage girl who held an empty birdcage in one hand and a shovel in the other. Each looked glassy-eyed and feverish. The young mother was clearly trembling. Their faces were dripping with sweat. Their eyes were filled with defeat. The old woman held out dirty, empty hands.
"Can you spare some water?" she asked.
But even as she asked her the question, she looked unconvinced, beaten. Vian opened the gate.
"Of course. Would you like to come in? Sit down, perhaps?"
The old woman shook her head.
"We are ahead of them. There is nothing for those in the back."
Vian didn't know what the woman meant, but it didn't matter. She could see that the women were suffering from exhaustion and hunger.
"Just a moment."
She went into the house and packed them some bread and raw carrots and a small bit of cheese, all that she had to spare. She filled a wine bottle with water and returned, offering them the provisions.
"It's not much," she said. "It is more than we've had since Tours,"
the young woman said in a toneless voice.
"You were in Tours?"
Vian asked.
"Drink, Sabine,"
the old woman said, holding the water to the girl's lips. Vian was about to ask about Isabel when the old woman said sharply,
"They're here."
The young mother made a moaning sound and tightened her hold on the baby, who was so quiet, and his tiny fist so blue, that Vian gasped. The baby was dead. Vian knew about the kind of talon grief that wouldn't let go. She had fallen into the fathomless gray that warped a mind and made a mother keep holding on long after hope was gone.
"Go inside," the old woman said to Vian. "Lock your doors."
"But..." The ragged trio backed away, lurched really, as if Vian's breath had become noxious. And then she saw the mass of black shapes moving across the field and coming up the road. The smell preceded them. Human sweat and filth and body odor. As they neared, the miasma of black separated, peeled into forms. She saw people on the road and in the fields, walking, limping, coming toward her. Some were pushing bicycles or prams or dragging wagons. Dogs barked, babies cried. There was coughing, throat clearing, whining. They came forward, through the field and up the road, relentlessly moving closer, pushing one another aside, their voices rising. Vian couldn't help so many. She rushed into her house and locked the door behind her. Inside, she went from room to room, locking doors and closing shutters. When she was finished, she stood in the living room, uncertain, her heart pounding. The house began to shake just a little. The windows rattled. The shutters thumped against the stone exterior. Dust rained down from the exposed timbers of the ceiling. Someone pounded on the front door. It went on and on and on, fists landing on the front door in hammer blows that made Vian flinch. Sophie came running down the stairs, clutching Bébé to her chest.
"Maman!"
Vian opened her arms, and Sophie ran into her embrace. Vian held her daughter close as the onslaught increased. Someone pounded on the side door. The copper pots and pans hanging in the kitchen clanged together, made a sound like church bells. She heard the high squealing of the outdoor pump. They were getting water. Vian said to Sophie,
"Wait here one moment. Sit on the divan."
"Don't leave me."
Vian peeled her daughter away and forced her to sit down. Taking an iron poker from the side of the fireplace, she crept cautiously up the stairs. From the safety of her bedroom, she peered out the window, careful to remain hidden. There were dozens of people in her yard, mostly women and children, moving like a pack of hungry wolves. Their voices melded into a single, desperate growl. Vian backed away. What if the doors didn't hold? So many people could break down doors and windows, even walls. Terrified, she went back downstairs, not breathing until she saw Sophie still safe on the divan. Vian sat down beside her daughter and took her in her arms, letting Sophie curl up as if she were a much littler girl. She stroked her daughter's curly hair. A better mother, a stronger mother, would have had a story to tell right now, but Vian was so afraid that her voice had completely gone. All she could think was an endless, beginningless prayer.
"Please."
She pulled Sophie closer and said,
"Go to sleep, Sophie. I'm here."
"Maman,"
Sophie said, her voice almost lost in the pounding on the door.
"What if Tante Isabelle is out there?"
Vian stared down at Sophie's small, earnest face, covered now in a sheen of sweat and dust.
"God help her,"
was all she could think of to say. At the sight of the gray stone house, Isabel felt awash in exhaustion. Her shoulders sagged. The blisters on her feet became unbearable. In front of her, Gaetan opened the gate. She heard it clatter brokenly and tilt sideways. Leaning into him, she stumbled up to the front door. She knocked twice, wincing each time her bloodied knuckles hit the wood. No one answered. She pounded with both of her fists, trying to call out her sister's name, but her voice was too hoarse to find any volume. She staggered back, almost sinking to her knees in defeat.
"Where can you sleep?"
Gaetan said, holding her upright with his hand on her waist.
"In the back, the pergola."
He led her around the house to the backyard. In the lush, jasmine-perfumed shadows of the arbor, she collapsed to her knees. She hardly noticed that he was gone, and then he was back with some tepid water, which she gulped from his cupped hands. It wasn't enough. Her stomach gnarled with hunger, sent an ache deep, deep inside of her. Still, when he started to leave again, she reached out for him, mumbled something, a plea not to be left alone, and he sank down beside her, putting out his arm for her to rest her head upon. They lay side by side in the warm dirt, staring up through the black thicket of vines that looped around the timbers and cascaded to the ground. The heady aromas of jasmine and blooming roses and rich earth created a beautiful bower. And yet, even here, in this quiet, it was impossible to forget what they'd just been through and the changes that were close on their heels. She had seen a change in Gaetan, watched anger and impotent rage erase the compassion in his eyes and the smile from his lips. He had hardly spoken since the bombing, and when he did, his voice was clipped and curt. They both knew more about war now, about what was coming.
"You could be safe here with your sister," he said.
"I don't want to be safe, and my sister will not want me."
She twisted around to look at him. Moonlight came through in lacy patterns, illuminating his eyes, his mouth, leaving his nose and chin in darkness. He looked different again. Older already, in just these few days, careworn, angry. He smelled of sweat and blood and mud and death,
but she knew she smelled the same. "Have you heard of Edith Cavell?" she asked.
"Do I strike you as an educated man?"
She thought about that for a moment and then said, "Yes." He was quiet long enough that she knew she'd surprised him.
"I know who she is. She saved the lives of hundreds of Allied airmen in the Great War. She is famous for saying that patriotism is not enough." "And this is your hero? A woman executed by the enemy."
"A woman who made a difference," Isabel said, studying him. "I am relying on you, a criminal and a communist, to help me make a difference. Perhaps I am as mad and impetuous as they say."
"Who are they?"
"Everyone." She paused, felt her expectation gather close. She had made a point of never trusting anyone, and yet she believed Gaetan. He looked at her as if she mattered.
"You will take me, as you promised." "You know how such bargains are sealed?"
"How?"
"With a kiss."
"Quit teasing. This is serious."
"What is more serious than a kiss on the brink of war?"
He was smiling, but not quite. That banked anger was in his eyes again, and it frightened her, reminded her that she really didn't know him at all.
"I would kiss a man who was brave enough to take me into battle with him." "I think you know nothing of kissing," he said with a sigh.
"Shows what you know." She rolled away from him and immediately missed his touch. Trying to be nonchalant, she rolled back to face him and felt his breath on her eyelashes.
"You may kiss me then, to seal our deal."
He reached out slowly, put a hand around the back of her neck, and pulled her toward him.
"Are you sure?"
he asked, his lips almost touching hers. She didn't know if he was asking about going off to war or granting permission for a kiss, but right now, in this moment, it didn't matter. Isabel had traded kisses with boys as if they were pennies to be left on park benches and lost in chair cushions, meaningless. Never before, not once, had she really yearned for a kiss.
"Oui,"
she whispered, leaning toward him. At his kiss, something opened up inside the scraped, empty interior of her heart, unfurled. For the first time, her romantic novels made sense. She realized that the landscape of a woman's soul could change as quickly as a world at war.
"I love you," she whispered.
She hadn't said these words since she was 4 years old. Then it had been to her mother. At her declaration, Gaetan's expression changed, hardened. The smile he gave her was so tight and false, she couldn't make sense of it.
"What? Did I do something wrong?"
"No, of course not," he said.
"We are lucky to have found each other," she said.
"We are not lucky, Isabel. Trust me on this."
As he said it, he drew her in for another kiss. She gave herself over to the sensation of the kiss, let it become the whole of her universe, and knew finally how it felt to be enough for someone. When Vianna woke, she noticed the quiet first. Somewhere a bird sang. She lay perfectly still in bed, listening. Beside her, Sophie snored and grumbled in her sleep. Vianne went to the window, lifting the blackout shade. In her yard, apple branches hung like broken arms from the trees. The gate hung sideways, two of its three hinges ripped out. Across the road, the hayfield was flattened, the flowers crushed. The refugees who'd come through had left belongings and refuse in their wake. Suitcases, buggies, coats too heavy to carry and too hot to wear, pillowcases and wagons. Vianne went downstairs and cautiously opened the front door. Listening for noise, hearing none, she unlatched the lock and turned the knob. They had destroyed her garden, ripping up anything that looked edible,
leaving broken stalks and mounds of dirt. Everything was ruined, gone. Feeling defeated, she walked around the house to the backyard, which had also been ravaged. She was about to go back inside when she heard a sound. A mewling. Maybe a baby crying. There it was again. Had someone left an infant behind? She moved cautiously across the yard to the wooden pergola draped in roses and jasmine. Isabel lay curled up on the ground, her dress ripped to shreds, her face cut up and bruised, her left eye swollen nearly shut, a piece of paper pinned to her bodice.
Isabel!
Her sister's chin tilted upward slightly. She opened one bloodshot eye.
Fee,
she said in a cracked, hoarse voice.
Thanks for locking me out.
Vianne went to her sister and knelt beside her.
Isabel, you are covered in blood and bruised. Were you...
Isabel seemed not to understand for a moment.
Oh, it is not my blood. Most of it isn't anyway.
She looked around.
Where's Gate?
What? Isabel staggered to her feet, almost toppling over.
Did he leave me? He did.
She started to cry.
He left me.
Come on, Vianne said gently. She guided her sister into the cool interior of the house, where Isabel kicked off her blood-spattered shoes, let them crack into the wall and clatter to the floor. Bloody footprints followed them into the bathroom tucked beneath the stairs. While Vianne heated water and filled the bath, Isabel sat on the floor, her legs splayed out, her feet discolored by blood, muttering to herself and wiping tears from her eyes, which turned to mud on her cheeks. When the bath was ready, Vianne returned to Isabel, gently undressing her. Isabel was like a child, pliable, whimpering in pain. Vianne unbuttoned the back of Isabel's once red dress and peeled it away, afraid that the slightest breath might topple her sister over. Isabel's lacy undergarments were stained in places with blood. Vianne unlaced the corseted midsection of the foundation and eased it off. Isabel gritted her teeth and stepped into the tub. Lean back. Isabel did as she was told, and Vianne poured hot water over her sister's head, keeping the water from her sister's eyes. All the while, as she washed Isabel's dirty hair and bruised body, she kept up a steady, soothing croon of meaningless words meant to comfort. She helped Isabel out of the tub and dried her body with a soft, white towel. Isabel stared at her, slack-jawed, blank-eyed. How about some sleep? Vianne said.
Sleep,
Isabel mumbled, her head lolling to one side. Vianne brought Isabel a nightdress that smelled of lavender and rosewater and helped her into it. Isabel could hardly keep her eyes open as Vianne guided her to the upstairs bedroom and settled her beneath a light blanket. Isabel was asleep before her head hit the pillow. Isabel woke to darkness. She remembered daylight. Where was she? She sat up so quickly her head spun. She took a few shallow breaths and then looked around. The upstairs bedroom at Le Jardin, her old room, it did not give her a warm feeling. How often had Madame Doom locked her in the bedroom for her own good?
Don't think about that, she said aloud.
An even worse memory followed. Gaetan. He had abandoned her after all. It filled her with the kind of bone-deep disappointment she knew so well. Had she learned nothing in life? People left. She knew that. They especially left her. She dressed in the shapeless blue house dress Vianne had left draped across the foot of the bed. Then she went down the narrow, shallow-stepped stairs, holding onto the iron banister. Every pain-filled step felt like a triumph. Downstairs, the house was quiet, except for the crackling, staticky sound of a radio on at low volume. She was pretty sure Marie Chevalier was singing a love song. Perfect. Vianne was in the kitchen, wearing a gingham apron over a pale yellow house dress. A floral scarf covered her hair. She was peeling potatoes with a paring knife. Behind her, a cast-iron pot made a cheery little bubbling sound. The aromas made Isabel's mouth water. Vianne rushed forward to pull out a chair at the small table in the kitchen's corner. "Here, sit." Isabel fell onto the seat. Vianne brought her a plate that was already prepared. A hunk of still-warm bread, a triangle of cheese, a smear of quince paste, and a few slices of ham. Isabel took the bread in her red, scraped-up hands, lifting it up to her face, breathing in the yeasty smell. Her hands were shaking as she picked up a knife and slathered the bread with fruit and cheese. When she set down the knife, it clattered. She picked up the bread and bit into it. The single best bite of food of her life. The hard crust of the bread, its pillow-soft interior, the buttery cheese and the fruit all combined to make her practically swoon. She ate the rest of it like a madwoman, barely noticing the cup of café noir her sister had set down beside her.
"Where's Sophie?"
Isabel asked, her cheeks bulging with food. It was difficult to stop eating, even to be polite. She reached for a peach, felt its fuzzy ripeness in her hands, and bit into it. Juice dribbled down her chin.
"She's next door, playing with Sarah. You remember my friend, Rachel?"
"I remember her," Isabel said. Vianne poured herself a tiny cup of espresso and brought it to the table, where she sat down. Isabel burped and covered her mouth.
"Pardon me. I think a lapse in manners can be overlooked," Vianne said with a smile. "You haven't met Madame Dufour. No doubt she would hit me with a brick for that transgression,"
Isabel sighed. Her stomach hurt now. She felt like she might vomit. She wiped her moist chin with her sleeve.
"What is the news from Paris?"
"The swastika flag flies from the Eiffel Tower."
"And Papa?"
"Fine," he says.
"Worried about me, I'll bet,"
Isabel said bitterly.
"He shouldn't have sent me away. But when has he ever done anything else?"
A look passed between them. It was one of the few memories they shared, that abandonment. But clearly Vianne didn't want to remember it.
"We hear there were more than 10 million of you on the roads." "The crowds weren't the worst of it," Isabel said. "We were mostly women and children, V, and old men and boys, and they just obliterated us."
"It's over now, thank God," Vianne said. "It's best to focus on the good."
"Who is Gaetan?"
"You spoke of him in your delirium." Isabel picked at one of the scrapes on the back of her hand, realizing an instant too late that she should have let it alone. The scab ripped away and blood bubbled up.
"Maybe he has to do with this,"
Vianne said when the silence elongated. She pulled a crumpled piece of paper out of her apron pocket. It was the note that had been pinned to Isabel's bodice. Dirty, bloody fingerprints ran across the paper. On it was written, "You are not ready." Isabel felt the world drop out from under her. It was a ridiculous, girlish reaction, overblown, and she knew it, but still it hit her hard, wounded deep. He had wanted to take her with him until the kiss. Somehow he'd tasted the lack in her.
"He's no one," she said grimly, taking the note, crumpling it. "Just a boy with black hair and a sharp face who tells lies. He's nothing."
Then she looked at Vianne.
"I'm going off to the war. I don't care what anyone thinks. I'll drive an ambulance or roll bandages, anything."
"Oh, for heaven's sake, Isabel. Paris is overrun. The Nazis control the city. What is an 18-year-old girl to do about all of that?"
"I am not going to hide out in the country while the Nazis destroy France.
And let's face it, you have never exactly felt sisterly toward me.
Her aching face tightened.
I'll be leaving as soon as I can walk.
You will be safe here, Isabel. That's what matters. You must stay.
Safe, Isabel spat. You think that is what matters now, Vianne? Let me tell you what I saw out there. French troops running away from the enemy. Nazis murdering innocents. Maybe you can ignore that, but I won't.
You will stay here and be safe. We will speak of it no more.
When have I ever been safe with you, Vianne? Isabel said, seeing hurt blossom in her sister's eyes.
I was young, Isabel. I tried to be a mother to you.
Oh, please, let's not start with a lie.
After I lost the baby... Isabel turned her back on her sister and limped away before she said something unforgivable. She clasped her hands to still their trembling. This was why she hadn't wanted to return to this house and see her sister, why she'd stayed away for years. There was too much pain between them. She turned up the radio to drown out her thoughts. A voice crackled over the airwaves.
Maréchal Pétain speaking to you.
Isabel frowned. Pétain was a hero of the Great War, a beloved leader of France. She turned up the volume further. Vianne appeared beside her.
I assume the direction of the government of France.
Static overtook his deep voice, crackled through it. Isabel thumped the radio impatiently.
Our admirable army, which is fighting with a heroism worthy of its long military traditions against an enemy superior in numbers and arms.
Static. Isabel hit the radio again, whispering,
Zut!
In these painful hours I think of the unhappy refugees who in extreme misery clog our roads. I express to them my compassion and my solicitude. It is with a broken heart that I tell you today it is necessary to stop fighting.
We've won? Vianne said. Shh, Isabel said sharply.
Addressed myself last night to the adversary to ask him if he is ready to speak with me as soldier to soldier after the actual fighting is over and with honor, the means of putting an end to hostilities.
The old man's words droned on, saying things like trying days, control their anguish, and worst of all, destiny of the fatherland. Then he said the word Isabel never thought she'd hear in France. Surrender. Isabel hobbled out of the room on her bloody feet and went into the backyard, needing air suddenly, unable to draw a decent breath. Surrender. France. To Hitler. It must be for the best, her sister said calmly. When had Vianne come out here? You've heard about Maréchal Pétain. He is a hero unparalleled. If he says we must quit fighting, we must. I'm sure he'll reason with Hitler. Vianne reached out. Isabel yanked away. The thought of Vianne's comforting touch made her feel sick. She limped around to face her sister.
You don't reason with men like Hitler.
So you know more than our heroes now?
I know we shouldn't give up.
Vianne made a tisking sound, a little scuff of disappointment.
If Maréchal Pétain thinks surrender is best for France, it is, period. At least the war will be over and our men will come home. You are a fool,
Vianne said. Fine, and went back into the house. Isabel tented a hand over her eyes and stared up into the bright and cloudless sky. How long would it be before all this blue was filled with German aeroplanes? She didn't know how long she stood there, imagining the worst, remembering how the Nazis had opened fire on innocent women and children in Tours, obliterating them, turning the grass red with their blood.
Tante Isabel?
Isabel heard the small, tentative voice as if from far away. She turned slowly. A beautiful girl stood at Le Jardin's back door. She had skin like her mother's, as pale as fine porcelain, and expressive eyes that appeared coal black from this distance, as dark as her father's. She could have stepped from the pages of a fairy tale, Snow White or Sleeping Beauty.
"You can't be Sophie," Isabel said. "The last time I saw you, you were sucking your thumb." "I still do sometimes," Sophie said with a conspiratorial smile. "You won't tell?"
"Me? I am the best of secret keepers." Isabel moved toward her, thinking, "My niece. Family.
Shall I tell you a secret about me, just so that we are fair?"
Sophie nodded earnestly, her eyes widening.
"I can make myself invisible." "No, you can't."
Isabel saw Vianne appear at the back door.
"Ask your maman. I have sneaked onto trains and climbed out of windows and run away from convent dungeons. All of this because I can disappear."
"Isabel," Vianne said sternly. Sophie stared up at Isabel, enraptured.
"Really?"
Isabel glanced at Vianne.
"It is easy to disappear when no one is looking at you." "I am looking at you," Sophie said. "Will you make yourself invisible now?"
Isabel laughed.
"Of course not. Magic, to be its best, must be unexpected. Don't you agree? And now, shall we play a game of checkers?"
Chapter 8. The surrender was a bitter pill to swallow, but Maréchal Pétain was an honorable man, a hero of the last war with Germany. Yes, he was old, but Vianne shared the belief that this only gave him a better perspective from which to judge their circumstances. He had fashioned a way for their men to come home, so it wouldn't be like the Great War. Vianne understood what Isabel could not. Pétain had surrendered on behalf of France to save lives and preserve their nation and their way of life. It was true that the terms of this surrender were difficult. France had been divided into two zones, the occupied zone, the north half of the country and the coastal regions, including Carrevaux, was to be taken over and governed by the Nazis. The great middle of the country, the land that lay below Paris and above the sea, would be the free zone, governed by a new French government in Vichy, led by Maréchal Pétain himself, in collaboration with the Nazis. Immediately upon France's surrender, food became scarce. Laundry soap, unobtainable. Ration cards could not be counted upon. Phone service became unreliable, as did the mail. The Nazis effectively cut off communication between cities and towns. The only mail allowed was on official German postcards. But for Vianne, these were not the worst of the changes. Isabel became impossible to live with. Several times since the surrender, while Vianne toiled to reconstruct and replant her garden and repair her damaged fruit trees, she had paused in her work and seen Isabel standing at the back gate, staring up at the sky, as if some dark and horrible thing were headed this way. All Isabel could talk about was the monstrosity of the Nazis and their determination to kill the French. She had no ability, of course, to hold her tongue, and since Vianne refused to listen, Sophie became her sister's audience, her acolyte. Isabel filled poor Sophie's head with terrible images of what would happen, so much so that the child had nightmares. Vianne dared not leave the two of them alone, and so today, like each of the previous days, she made them both come to town with her to see what their ration cards would get them. They had been standing in a food queue at the butcher's shop for 2 hours already. Isabel had been complaining nearly that whole time. Apparently, it made no sense to her that she should have to shop for food.
"Vianne, look," Isabel said.
More dramatics.
"Vianne, look."
She turned, just to silence her sister, and saw them. Germans. Up and down the street, windows and doors slammed shut. people disappeared so quickly, Vian found herself suddenly standing alone on the sidewalk with her sister and daughter. She grabbed Sophie and pulled her against the butcher shop's closed door. Isabel stepped defiantly into the street.
Isabel!
Vian hissed. But Isabel stood her ground, her green eyes bright with hatred, her pale, fine-boned, beautiful face marred by scratches and bruises. The green lorry in the lead came to a halt in front of Isabel. In the back, soldiers sat on benches, facing one another, rifles laid casually across their laps. They looked young and clean-shaven and eager in brand-new helmets with medals glinting on their gray-green uniforms. Young, most of all. Not monsters, just boys, really. They craned their necks to see what had stopped traffic. At the sight of Isabel standing there, the soldiers started to smile and wave. Vian grabbed Isabel's hand and yanked her out of the way. The military entourage rumbled past them, a string of vehicles and motorcycles and lorries covered in camouflaged netting. Armored tanks rolled thunderously on the cobblestone street. And then came the soldiers. Two long lines of them, marching into town. Isabel walked boldly alongside them up Rue Victor Hugo. The Germans waved to her, looking more like tourists than conquerors.
Maman, you can't let her go off by herself, Sophie said.
Merde!
Vian clutched Sophie's hand and ran after Isabel. They caught up with her in the next block. The town square, usually full of people, had practically emptied. Only a few townspeople dared to remain as the German vehicles pulled up in front of the town hall and parked. An officer appeared. Or Vian assumed he was an officer because of the way he began barking orders. Soldiers marched around the large cobblestone square, claiming it with their overwhelming presence. They ripped down the flag of France and replaced it with their Nazi flag, a huge black swastika against a red and black background. When it was in place, the troops stopped as one, extended their right arms, and yelled,
Heil Hitler!
If I had a gun, Isabel said, I'd show them not all of us wanted to surrender.
Shh, Vian said. You'll get us all killed with that mouth of yours. Let's go.
No, I want...
Vian spun to face Isabel.
Enough! You will not draw attention to us. Is that understood?
Isabel gave one last hate-filled glance at the marching soldiers and then let Vian lead her away. They slipped from the main street and entered a dark cleft in the walls that led to a back alley behind the milliner's shop. They could hear the soldiers singing. Then a shot rang out, and another. Someone screamed. Isabel stopped.
Don't you dare,
Vian said.
Move!
They kept to the dark alleys, ducking into doorways when they heard voices coming their way. It took longer than usual to get through town, but eventually they made it to the dirt road. They walked silently past the cemetery and all the way home. Once inside, Vian slammed the door behind her and locked it.
You see?
Isabel said instantly. She had obviously been waiting to throw out the question.
Go to your room,
Vian said to Sophie. Whatever Isabel was going to say, she didn't want Sophie to hear. Vian eased the hat from her head and set down her empty basket. Her hands were shaking.
They're here because of the airfield,
Isabel said. She began pacing.
I didn't think it would happen so fast, even with the surrender. I didn't believe. I thought our soldiers would fight anyway. I thought... Quit biting your nails. You'll make them bleed, you know.
Isabel looked like a madwoman, with her waist-length blonde hair falling loose from its braid and her bruised face twisted with fury.
The Nazis are here, Vian, in Carivaux. Their flag flies from the Hôtel de Ville as it flies from the Arc de Triomphe and the Eiffel Tower. They weren't in town 5 minutes and a shot was fired. The war is over, Isabel. Maréchal Pétain said so. The war is over? The war is over?
Did you see them back there with their guns and their flags and their arrogance? We need to get out of here, V. We'll take Sophie and leave Carivaux.
And go where?
Anywhere. Lyon, maybe. Provence. What was that town in the Dordogne where Maman was born? Brantôme. We could find her friend, that Basque woman. What was her name? She might help us.
You are giving me a headache.
A headache is the least of your problems, Isabel said, pacing again.
Vianne approached her.
You are not going to do anything crazy or stupid. Am I understood?
Isabel growled in frustration and marched upstairs, slamming the door behind her. Surrender. The word stuck in Isabel's thoughts. That night, as she lay in the downstairs guest bedroom, staring up at the ceiling, she felt frustration lodge in her so deeply she could hardly think straight. Was she supposed to spend the war in this house, like some helpless girl, doing laundry and standing in food lines and sweeping the floor? Was she to stand by and watch the enemy take everything from France? She had always felt lonely and frustrated, or at least she had felt it for as long as she could remember, but never as sharply as now. She was stuck here in the country with no friends and nothing to do. No. There must be something she could do. Even here, even now. Hide the valuables. It was all that came to her. The Germans would loot the houses in town. Of that she had no doubt. And when they did, they would take everything of value. Her own government, cowards that they were, had known that. It was why they had emptied much of the Louvre and put fake paintings on the museum walls.
Not much of a plan, she muttered. But it was better than nothing.
The next day, as soon as Vianne and Sophie left for school, Isabel began. She ignored Vianne's request that she go to town for food. She couldn't stand to see the Nazis, and one day without meat would hardly matter. Instead, she searched the house, opening closets and rummaging through drawers, and looking under the beds. She took every item of value and set it on the trestle table in the dining room. There were lots of valuable heirlooms. Lacework tatted by her great-grandmother, a set of sterling silver salt and pepper shakers, a gilt-edged Limoges platter that had been their aunt's, several small Impressionist paintings, a tablecloth made of fine ivory Alençon lace, several photograph albums, a silver-framed photograph of Vianne and Antoine and baby Sophie, her mother's pearls, Vianne's wedding dress, and more. Isabel boxed up everything that would fit in a wooden-trimmed leather trunk, which she dragged through the trampled grass, wincing every time it scraped on a stone or thudded into something. By the time she reached the barn, she was breathing hard and sweating. The barn was smaller than she remembered. The hayloft, once the only place in the world where she was happy, was really just a small tier on the second floor, a bit of floor perched at the top of a rickety ladder and beneath the roof, through which slats of sky could be seen. How many hours had she spent up here alone with her picture books, pretending that someone cared enough to come looking for her? Waiting for her sister, who was always out with Rachel or Antoine. She pushed that memory aside. The center of the barn was no more than 30 feet wide. It had been built by her great-grandfather to hold buggies, back when the family had money. Now there was only an old Renault parked in the center. The stalls were filled with tractor parts and web-draped wooden ladders and rusted farm implements. She closed the barn door and went to the automobile. The driver's side door opened with a squeaking, clattering reluctance. She climbed in, started the engine, drove forward about 8 feet, and then parked. The trap door was revealed now, about 5 feet long and 4 feet wide, and made of planks connected by leather straps. The cellar door was nearly impossible to see, especially as it was now, covered in dust and old hay. She pulled the trap door open, letting it rest against the automobile's dinged-up bumper, and peered down into the musty darkness.
Holding the trunk by its strap, she turned on her torchlight and clamped it under her other armpit and climbed down the ladder slowly, clanking the trunk down, rung by rung, until she was at the bottom. The trunk clattered onto the dirt floor beside her. Like the loft, this hidey hole had seemed bigger to her as a child. It was about 8 feet wide and 10 feet long, with shelving along one side and an old mattress on the floor. The shelves used to hold barrels for winemaking, but a lantern was the only thing left on the shelves. She tucked the trunk into the back corner and then went back to the house where she gathered up some preserved food, blankets, some medical supplies, her father's hunting shotgun, and a bottle of wine, all of which she put out on the shelves. When she climbed back up the ladder, she found Vianne in the barn.
"What in the world are you doing out here?"
Isabel wiped her dusty hands on the worn cotton of her skirt.
"Hiding your valuables and putting supplies down here, in case we need to hide from the Nazis. Come down and look. I did a good job, I think."
She backed down the ladder, and Vianne followed her into the darkness. Lighting a lantern, Isabel proudly showed off Papa's shotgun and the foodstuffs and medical supplies. Vianne went straight to their mother's jewelry box, opening it. Inside lay brooches and earrings and necklaces, mostly costume pieces. But at the bottom, lying on blue velvet, were the pearls that Grand-Mère had worn on her wedding day and given to Maman to wear on her wedding day.
"You may need to sell them someday,"
Isabel said. Vianne clamped the box shut.
"They are heirlooms, Isabel. For Sophie's wedding day and yours, I would never sell them."
She sighed impatiently and turned to Isabel.
"What food were you able to get in town?" "I did this instead." "Of course you did. It's more important to hide Maman's pearls than to feed your niece supper. Honestly, Isabel."
Vianne climbed up the ladder, her displeasure revealed in tiny, disgusted huffs. Isabel left the cellar and drove the Renault back into place over the door. Then she hid the keys behind a broken board in one of the stalls. At the last moment, she disabled the automobile by removing the distributor cap. She hid it with the keys. When she finally returned to the house, Vianne was in the kitchen frying potatoes in a cast-iron skillet.
"I hope you aren't hungry."
"I'm not."
She moved past Vianne, barely making eye contact.
"Oh, and I hid the keys and distributor cap in the first stall, behind a broken board."
In the living room, she turned on the radio and scooted close, hoping for news from the BBC. There was a staticky crackle, and then an unfamiliar voice said,
"This is the BBC. General de Gaulle is speaking to you."
"Vianne!"
Isabel yelled toward the kitchen.
"Who is General de Gaulle?"
Vianne came into the living room, drying her hands on her apron.
"What is..."
"Shh!" Isabel snapped.
"The leaders who have been at the head of the French army for many years have formed a government. On the pretext that our army has been defeated, this government has approached the enemy with a view to ceasing hostilities."
Isabel stared at the small wooden radio, transfixed. This man they'd never heard of spoke directly to the people of France, not at them as Pétain had done, but to them in an impassioned voice.
"Pretext of defeat! I knew it!"
"We certainly have been and still are submerged by the mechanical strength of the enemy, both on land and in the air. The tanks, the aeroplanes, the tactics of the Germans astounded our generals to such an extent that they have been brought to the pain which they are in today. But has the last word been said? Has all hope disappeared? Is the defeat final?"
"Mon Dieu!"
Isabel said. This was what she'd been waiting to hear. There was something to be done, a fight to engage in. The surrender wasn't final.
"Whatever happens," de Gaulle's voice went on, "the flame of French resistance must not and shall not die."
Isabel hardly noticed that she was crying. The French hadn't given up. Now all Isabel had to do was figure out how to answer this call.
2 days after the Nazis occupied Carrivaux, they called a meeting for the late afternoon. Everyone was to attend, no exceptions. Even so, Vianne had had to fight with Isabel to get her to come. As usual, Isabel did not think ordinary rules pertained to her, and she wanted to use defiance to show her displeasure. As if the Nazis cared what one impetuous 18-year-old girl thought of their occupation of her country.
"Wait here," Vianne
said impatiently when she'd finally gotten Isabel and Sophie out of the house. She gently closed the broken gate behind them. It gave a little click of closure. Moments later, Rachel appeared on the road, coming toward them with the baby in her arms and Sarah at her side.
"That's my best friend Sarah,"
Sophie said, gazing up at Isabel.
"Isabel," Rachel said with a smile, "it's good to see you again."
"Is it?"
Isabel said. Rachel moved closer to Isabel.
"That was a long time ago," Rachel said gently. "We were young and stupid and selfish. I'm sorry we treated you badly, ignored you. That must have been very painful."
Isabel's mouth opened, closed. For once, she had nothing to say.
"Let's go,"
Vianne said, irritated that Rachel had said to Isabel what Vianne had not been able to.
"We shouldn't be late."
Even this late in the day, the weather was unseasonably warm, and in no time Vianne felt herself beginning to sweat. In town, they joined the grumbling crowd that filled the narrow cobblestone street from storefront to storefront. The shops were closed, and the windows were shuttered, even though the heat would be unbearable when they got home. Most of the display cases were empty, which was hardly surprising. The Germans ate so much. Even worse, they left food on their plates in the cafes. Careless and cruel it was, with so many mothers beginning to count the jars in their cellars so that they could dole out every precious bite to their children. Nazi propaganda was everywhere, on windows and shop walls, posters that showed smiling German soldiers surrounded by French children, with captions designed to encourage the French to accept their conquerors and become good citizens of the Reich. As the crowd approached the town hall, the grumbling stopped. Up close, it felt even worse. This following of instructions, walking blindly into a place with guarded doors and locked windows.
"We shouldn't go in," Isabel said.
Rachel, who stood between the sisters, towering over both of them, made a tisking sound. She resettled the baby in her arms, patting his back in a comforting rhythm.
"We have been summoned."
"All the more reason to hide," Isabel said.
"Sophie and I are going in,"
Vianne said, although she had to admit that she felt a prickly sense of foreboding.
"I have a bad feeling about it," Isabel muttered.
Like a thousand-legged centipede, the crowd moved forward into the great hall. Tapestries had once hung from these walls, leftover treasures from the time of kings, when the Loire Valley had been the royal hunting ground. But all that was gone now. Instead, there were swastikas and propagandist posters on the walls. "Trust in the Reich," and a huge painting of Hitler. Beneath the painting stood a man wearing a black field tunic decorated with medals and iron crosses, knee breeches, and spit-shined boots. A red swastika armband circled his right bicep. When the hall was full, the soldiers closed the oak doors, which creaked in protest. The officer at the front of the hall faced them, shot his right arm out, and said,
"Heil Hitler!"
The crowd murmured softly among themselves. What should they do?
"Heil Hitler,"
a few said grudgingly. The room began to smell of sweat and leather polish and cigarette smoke.
"I am Sturmbannführer Weld of the Geheime Staatspolizei, the Gestapo,"
the man in the black uniform said in heavily accented French.
"I am here to carry out the terms of the armistice on behalf of the Fatherland and the Führer." It will be of little hardship on those of you who obey the rules.
He cleared his throat.
The rules. All radios are to be turned into us at the town hall immediately.